CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. The first segment of our show was a post-dated interview, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Anna Kennedy will be giving us an update on the Canadian Lymphedema Framework. So, can you give me a bit of an update on the framework?
Sure. Yep. It was officially launched in 2009. It's modeled on and aligned with an international lymphedema framework that started as a collaboration between health professionals, community organizations, patients, and industry partners, just to improve the standards of lymphedema management in Canada and other parts of the world.
So how do you reach out to the affected communities?
Well, in several ways. The CLF is the national voice in Canada for lymphedema, so we've got a comprehensive website that has over 60-70 pages of educational material for both patients as well as health professionals. We also have a Pathways magazine, which is the only national magazine for lymphedema patients and clinicians, and that goes across Canada, actually the U.S., Europe, and Australia as well. We host national conferences. The most recent one we had was in the fall of last year, but it was our first virtual one because of the pandemic. But because of the pandemic, we actually reached people well outside of Canada as well. We had people calling in and Zooming in for 2 days from Europe and Bahrain and Dubai, Australia. It was quite incredible.
So,
and we've got an active social media campaign, Instagram, Facebook, and that's how we reach out.
So for those who might not be as familiar, how does lymphedema typically affect persons?
How does it affect? It's basically a chronic swelling. And so it's either due to a genetic disorder, so that's called primary lymphedema, and people are born with it, or it could manifest itself during puberty. But more common is secondary lymphedema, means it's acquired through another means. So it's either cancer-related or due to obesity or chronic venous insufficiency or trauma or surgical procedures to, you know, certain areas of the body where lymph nodes have been affected. And so even though most people think of lymphedema as specifically cancer-related, we've shown in the last few years through some of our prevalence charts that cancer-related lymphedema is actually the not as common as patients getting lymphedema from chronic venous insufficiency or immobility or severe obesity. That's sort of the growing trend now for many chronic conditions, including lymphedema.
No offhand about how many people have lymphedema?
Yes, in Canada we estimate it's about over a million, which is a huge number. It's more than a lot of other conditions like Parkinson's and lots of other conditions that get more coverage and more awareness. We seem to stay under the radar screen. Many physicians and health professionals don't know about it, and consequently, many patients don't learn about it early enough to be diagnosed and treated before it progresses too far.
So that being said, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis or the condition being mistaken for something else?
Yes, it could be. I mean, for people that are obese, for example, many physicians will just look at their limbs, typically their legs, and say, you know, lose some weight and the swelling will go away. but that doesn't help. Diuretics don't help. I mean, it's not a typical fat buildup. It's a fluid buildup. It's a chronic swelling of the lymphatic fluid that pools in certain areas because it's not moving effectively through the body anymore because the lymphatic system has been damaged or has been faulty because of genetic disorders.
So in your time providing support to those affected, has there been any success that stands out for you?
Yeah, I mean, when I started, I'm affected by lymphedema myself. I was diagnosed, I have it as a result of cervical cancer at 43, but I got lymphedema about 3-4 years after that. And when I started, I left the corporate world and sort of jumped into the nonprofit charitable world to promote and start this organization. And at that time, many, many physicians had not heard about lymphedema. And we got a lot of calls to the help desk from patients, you know, pleading, where do we go? What do we do? That has changed steadily over the last 15 years. I would say there's a lot more physicians that do know about lymphedema. We've focused a lot of our education towards the health professionals. So as an example, one of our key successes was a specific tool or card that was targeted to physicians in their language. It was just a one-page document, and that went inside the Canadian Medical Association journal that goes to all the physicians and surgeons across Canada. I think there's 85 or 90,000 of them. And so, those are some of the small ways that we're reaching to the clinicians that need to know about this so that when they have people coming into their office, with swollen limbs, they can understand it and diagnose it and put them in the right path for treatment.
So, from your own experience, do you have any advice for those out there who might be starting a diagnosis journey and might be asking the question, is this something I can manage? Is this something that's going to change my quality of life?
It's definitely manageable. I mean, our message has always been a message of hope. It's not, yes, it is a chronic condition, and as with any chronic condition, you've got to become your own advocate, and you've got to learn everything you can about it. You will become much more knowledgeable than your family physician because the family physician has many, many diseases that they need to be knowledgeable about, and most of them have not had much training within their medical training about lymphedema. We run some courses now for clinicians through the University of Alberta, some postgraduate courses for nurses, doctors, and therapists, etc. But I, as a patient, know much more about lymphedema than my family doctor because, it affects me. I need to understand what the treatment options are. I need to know how to control it, what affects it. You know, there's days of hot humidity, like today, where my leg is going to swell more than other days, and I know I need to take it a little more easy than perhaps another day. Maybe lay off, not play tennis as long, but I can still play tennis, but maybe just gear up on some of the activities that are outside. So definitely learning as much as they can about lymphedema and what some of the risks are of not looking after it. And the biggest risk for people with lymphedema is something called cellulitis, and that's a serious skin and tissue infection that can lead to life-threatening sepsis. And with every instance of the skin infection, lymphedema progressively gets worse. So I've had it 3 times in the last 15 years, and I learned early on that I need to have diligent self-care, skin care, look after myself. A healthy diet, an active lifestyle helps me manage that lymphedema. but I am just as active as anyone else. I walk, I play tennis, I swim, I continue with my exercise routines, but I also eat healthy and know that that's what I have to do to manage the lymphedema.
So where can people go about finding out more about lymphedema and the work you do?
Well, our website is an excellent place to start. It's www.canadalymph, that's LYMPH.ca. On that website, they'll learn all about lymphedema, about the resources available, also links to sign up for the Pathways Lymphedema Magazine, and links to all the provincial associations who can direct them to the local resources for therapists, doctors, clinicians, etc.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you could stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Great. That's it. That's pretty fast.
In this segment of our show, Leslie Hoskins will be telling us a little bit about Leader Dogs. So, can you tell me a little bit about your work?
Yeah, Leader Dogs for the Blind is a nonprofit organization located in Rochester Hills, Michigan. Our mission is to empower people who are blind or visually impaired with lifelong skills for safe and independent daily travel. We do that by offering a couple of different programs, all of which are completely free, including room, board, and airfare. So we have our guide dog training, which of course is the one we're most known for. We also have our orientation and mobility training, which is the long white cane training, and we have a teen summer camp.
So, how do you go about reaching out to the disability population to let them know that, that your work is available?
How do we kind of spread the word about what we're doing?
Yes.
We are doing the best that we can. We're always certainly open to suggestions, but we go to a lot of different conferences for professionals in the blindness field. We also are trying to talk to medical professionals, those who may be making those diagnoses. And then, of course, we're just trying to get in contact with actual clients, so people who could benefit from our services. So we do a lot of presentations as much as we can for support groups, so like low vision support groups, other agencies or organizations that have services for the blind and visually impaired. We try to be there as much as possible. Any way that we really can. We, of course, have the social media, so we're doing Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and Instagram and all of that as well. But that is one of the biggest things that we struggle with, is finding people to benefit from these services and letting them know we exist.
So the summer camp you mentioned, I'm curious, what sorts of activities does that include for youth with vision impairments?
Yeah, our teen summer camp is for 16 and 17-year-olds who are blind or visually impaired, and they come in from all over the U.S. and Canada. We fly them in. They stay on campus here. It's like staying in a hotel room. We do a lot of really fun things. So we really talk about leadership skills and being a leader in their friends group and their sports and their school, families, things like that. We also talk about accessible GPS. We talk about guide dog travel, and if that's the right choice for them. But we also go rock wall climbing, and we go zip lining. In the past, we've done tandem bike riding. We play lots of different games and activities. We do scavenger hunts. This year, actually, there was a zombie apocalypse, which was really fun and incorporated a lot of different activities. But the most important thing, or the best thing I think of camp, is that these kids are really coming and meeting other kids like themselves who are kind of going through the same things, and building a friendship, you know, kind of building that support network. So we do sneak in a little bit of learning, but honestly, most of the time, it's just so much fun.
When it comes to things like zip lining with blindness or vision impairment, what sort of training does that involve?
So we actually are really lucky. We partner with Lion's Bear Lake Camp in Lapeer, Michigan. And they are kind of all the experts in that area, and they're certified and kind of have all the education there. So it's really no training on our end or on our campers' ends because they are so qualified, the camp is. But each camper, you know, they put on the harness, and then the instructor there at Lion's Bear Lake Camp really gives them detailed instructions, and they're very serious about it. So they follow, they have rules like belay on, or I think that's the word. So they can't start climbing until they've confirmed with their person who's watching them that they're ready to go. And honestly, it's a team effort. What's so cool about these activities that we're doing is that everybody's helping. So whoever's climbing the wall, you know, they may not be able to see the next grip that they need to use to pull themselves up or where to put their foot. So team members down below are helping and, you know, kind of yelling up, okay, lift your right arm all the way up. Okay, now move it to the right. And kind of a team effort to kind of climb up those walls. And I would say 90% of the campers always make it up and then enjoy ziplining down.
So the zombie apocalypse you mentioned, did you use any sort of other sensory stimuli to keep it interesting for the campers?
We did. So it was very interesting. They kind of started out almost like in an escape room. So here at Leader Dog, we have a mock apartment in our basement, and that's really beneficial for training purposes with the dog of making sure that they're, you know, kind of following those house rules. But we used the mock apartment, and they were kind of locked in there until they found all these clues. So they had to use Braille. There was large print. There was tactile information. Of, you know, there was a clock at one point and they had to spin it to the felt piece. And then there was like a dial block, I guess you'd say. And you had to spin that to different textures and feelings. They had to pop balloons, which, you know, some kids did not enjoy that sound. And then they also at one point had kind of like Nerf shooter things and they had to aim towards the sounds of different things. So it was really, really intense. There were lots of pieces. They also, at one point, had to ride our conference bike, which is a 7-person bike. And so they had to give the driver instructions on where they had to go based on their last clue. A really fun part about the zombie apocalypse is we had team members who took some time out of their day to walk around and pretend to be zombies. So as the kids are riding the bikes, you know, the zombies are following behind them, making these groaning noises and shuffling their feet. So it was very interactive for everybody, and we got a lot of positive feedback from the campers.
So do you see yourself doing something like that again?
I think absolutely. I think we definitely learned some things that we can improve on, as it was our first zombie apocalypse. But yeah, each year at camp, we get more and more creative. Our team is absolutely amazing. We've got some new team members who are bringing some really fresh, creative ideas. And I think it'll just continue to grow and improve each year. You know, the feedback from campers is really important and what they provide and what they didn't like or did like. And we kind of go off of that. I would never say camp is the same each year. Every year is very different based on what we've learned the previous year.
So kind of curious. When you mentioned you slipped in some education, which is always an interesting thing to do in fun activities, how do you speak to the myths or misperceptions regarding vision impairments?
You know, I think education and advocacy are incredibly important, and we do our best here to let others know that, you know, whether you're visually impaired, whether you're hearing impaired, whether it's or hard of hearing, any of those different things, everybody can do everything. It's just kind of outside of the box thinking. There's just a different way to do it. And so we certainly want to empower our clients. We want to empower our campers. And we do want to educate the population. So we recently started a podcast called Taking the Lead by Leader Dogs for the Blind. And that has really gained some traction. And that's what we do a lot of times is we're educating on different things that our clients are experiencing or how something has made them felt in hopes that somebody's going to hear that and then make a change, right? Or maybe educate somebody else that they learned something new. You know, and it happens here too. One of the things we talked about the other day is a good friend of mine said something about guess who to a client. And luckily they had a great relationship and so the client knew who it was instantly. But I was laughing and saying, that's the worst game to play with somebody who's blind or visually impaired. That's not fair to them. And it was a learning opportunity for everybody. So anything we can do to help educate the community, we do.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
CJAM 99.1 FM is hiring for the position of station manager. This full-time salary position is 35 hours a week and requires a flexible individual who is available for some evening, weekend, and on-call duties when required. The station manager is ultimately responsible for all aspects of the station operations. Duties include CRTC and CJAM regulation, administrative work, grant writing, hiring, training, and supervision, programming, and outreach. Applications will be accepted until October 10th, 2022. Find out more on our website at cjam.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about leader dogs from Leslie Hoskins, and Anna Kennedy gave us an update on Canada's lymphedema framework. In this segment of our show, Maureen Hahn will be telling us about CCRW. So, can you tell me a little bit about the work of CCRW?
Sure. So, CCRW, the Canadian Council on Rehabilitation at Work, we work with job seekers with disabilities to find meaningful and equitable employment. We do that in a couple of ways. The first way we do that is by supporting the individual, the person with a disability, in order to understand their talent, their accommodation needs, their disclosure possibilities, and really try and support them, especially through a lens of talent. We do not take a pity hire approach. We believe that everybody's got talent that they can bring to the workplace. So we do that, but we also recognize that there's two sides to the equation of employment. There's the talent side, but there's also the employer side. So we work with employers to try to get them disability confident. And what I mean by that is that they feel confident in the hiring, promoting, advancement, and even the termination when needed of people with disabilities within their organization. And we do that through a variety of services and approaches. And we do that because if we don't change the landscape of employment for people with disabilities with an employer lens, then I think it's pretty discriminatory. I think that only asking people with disabilities to morph and change and upskill and reskill and jump through the hoops and make sure that they are accommodated for the work, I think that that's a little bit discriminatory if we're not expecting employers to do the same thing.
So I want to speak to one of your earlier points there about how it isn't pity hiring. If it were to be perceived as that, do you think a person with a disability would be less likely to try and advance in their given field or just would kind of get stuck, as it were, in one position?
I think it's actually even worse than that. I think that pity hires lead to unsustainable employment. So I think that if somebody is hiring somebody with a disability because they have a disability and because they think that they're doing the right thing by giving this person a handout, then I think that it's not based on talent. If it's based on talent and they want to make sure they have a diverse workforce, that's something different. But if they're doing it just because this person needs a job, it won't be sustained. It won't be sustained for lots of reasons, and historically we know that that's the truth. Go ahead.
So I'm curious, how do you speak to those myths and misperceptions of this being doing the right or the noble thing? How do you balance it so it benefits both the worker and the employer?
Yeah, so it's a good point, and there are lots of myths that are out there, and there are some myths that are out there that are still being used that are perceived to be positive for the person with a disability. So, like, for example, people with disabilities have lower accident rates at work. And so that is a statistic that has come out that is showing employers, hey, if you hire somebody with a disability, especially if it's in a labor job, they have less accidents, and so therefore your insurance rates won't increase. So that might be true, but it's not a selling point for hiring anybody. Nobody wants, no business should be hiring somebody because they're going to get a break in their insurance rates. They should hire people because they can do the job. Another myth along those lines is that people with disabilities stay longer in their jobs. They have more loyalty. Well, I think that dogs may have loyalty. I don't think that people with disabilities are dogs. And so I think that to lump a whole bunch of people into a group that says that they're more loyal, I think we have to open that one up a little bit and see why they're more loyal. Is it that they're more loyal because there are benefits at the job that keep them there? Are they more loyal because they're so desperate to work that they're not going to go anywhere else? Or is it because they're being discriminated against for other jobs when other people actually do move on from those jobs? So those are just a couple of myths.
So in your time with CCRW, has there been any moment of advocacy that you would consider success that stands out for you?
Good question. Yes, I think so. I think that the moment of my biggest recognition of moment of success was back in 2017 when the Convention on the Rights for Persons with Disabilities, the UNCRPD, the committee came back and said that they were concerned that there was no policy for employment for people with disabilities. And we took that to another level and joined with like-minded people. We had a conference and we asked that question, what should we be doing with this? You know, that this is what the committee has come back with. And we heard resoundingly that, no, we don't want a policy. We're not the government. We're civil society. We don't want a policy per se. We want a strategy. So we created the Pan-Canadian Strategy for Disability and Work. And it's not CCRW's, it's not the steering committee's, it's the entire country's strategy. And that has now been, is one of the pieces of the new Disability Inclusion Action Plan that the federal government has created. One of the pillars is a employment strategy. And so that I think that that's pretty exciting. That's an exciting piece of policy or influence that civil society has had on the federal government. I don't know where it's going, but I think it's going to be great.
So if you could send any message to the community about what needs to happen next to keep the momentum going, what would you say?
I would say to get involved. I would say to be aware of what your rights are as workers with disabilities. I would say figure out what your talents are. And I would say to employers that if you're not hiring people with disabilities, you do not have a diverse workforce. You are not fulfilling your end of the bargain with your inclusion, equity, and diversity plans, because your EDIs have to include disability, have to include accessibility. And I think that employers now, without hiring people with disabilities, with the labor shortage that's going on, they're going to be left behind. They're not going to be able to find the talent. So it's a matter of making sure that you're changing your business ways to ensure that you're hiring people with talent with disabilities.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. Friends, I must admit, I find it completely fascinating someone would set up an escape room for people with vision impairments. It's always amazing to see the creativity, the ingenuity, the human spirit, seeing what can be done to adapt the world around us. Just incredible. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.